Welcome to Four Chicks Chatting, a womanish podcast that will engage, excite, and empower you as we chat about business and personal development, all with a healthy dose of humor. And now it's time to check in with our chicks, Kathy, Kristen, Mary Fran, and Robin.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Four Chicks Chatting. I am Mary Fran Bontempo. We're here with Kathy Marcino, Kristen Smedley. Our other chick, Robin Graham, is not with us today. Her son Sam's a football player having a procedure, so we wish them well. But we have an amazing fourth chick joining us today. And that fourth chick is Soraya Chamali, who wrote a book that I just love because I am the angry chick, as everybody who listens to us knows. And the book is called Rage Becomes Her. So we are so excited to have you with us, Soraya. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me today.
So I have to tell you, when I first saw this book, and we were chatting a bit before we got on the podcast here, and I said I was not angry at the time, which is a rather unusual state for me because usually I'm mad about something or another. But I was at the beach, which is my happy place, and I was in the library and happened to come across this book called Rage Becomes Her. And I just thought it was the title, first of all, thank you for that, was so powerful. And the fact that just within the title alone, you made an emotion that is supposed to be ugly on us, you made it right in that title alone something that was powerful and almost attractive.
Well, thank you. We took a long time deciding what the title should be, and it had many meetings, so it's really nice to hear that. Thank you.
Yeah, it resonated with me immediately. And I think the conversation about rage and anger is so pertinent given our public discourse now and what all of that is about. It's everybody's angry about something, but the fact that you're talking about this as an emotion that for women has been something that we've been told to suppress for so long, for generations, for always, for all time, that's not supposed to be something we claim. And if we do, we're crazy. If we act angry, we're nuts, we're crazy. And believe me, I've been called that on many, many occasions. But the fact that we are able to take that emotion now and not only acknowledge it, but use it for good is incredibly powerful. So how did you, I love some of the stories you tell, and the one about your mom throwing the plates, hilarious, totally, totally resonated with me. Mm-hmm. How did you come about this book? How did you decide to write this book?
So I had been writing about gender equality and social justice for a long time. I actually started in college and then was a writer for a few years after, and then I left writing entirely. And in about 2008, 2009, sort of came to and thought, wow, you know, I think that things are looking pretty bad, and no one seems to be really focused on what this means, like the intersection of gender inequality with all kinds of other key political issues. And so I started writing again pretty regularly, like two or three times a week. And then I had a book proposal which went through many lives, and then the election happened. And the election happened, and what was really striking to me was how much despair there was around that election, like real despair. And then I think there was a shock among, well, clearly from the surveys, I think there was a shock among white women, mainly. Initially, before the election, conservative white women were the angriest in the country. And then after the election, liberal white women were the angriest in the country. There was just a pendulum shift, right? And so I thought, okay, well, how can I write about these issues and sort of give a state of the union? What is it like to be a woman right now? But use this lens of anger, because anger was the prevailing feeling both in terms of interpersonal dynamics and public and political dynamics. And that's how I wrote. And I was really pissed off. Like, I said,
like right there, like, with you on that,
yes, one. You know, it wasn't like, this was not an anodyne sort of cold-hearted, let me just sit down and document this. And indeed, I wrote in the book, is it possible to write a book about women's anger and not become enraged? When it wasn't for me, right? I mean, and very often I'm talking to people who've read the book and they'll say, you know, I have a really hard time reading this before I get to sleep.
Don't read it before you try to go to sleep.
Read it during your workout.
It's a thriller of a whole different sort.
Like you definitely, and if you happen to sleep next to someone, it's not good for them.
The stuff of nightmares based on our reality. Yeah.
So that's how I came to write the book.
Well, like I said, it resonated with me on so many different levels. I mean, clearly, and I think that the timing of this, which was one of the things that struck me about it, was that this is maybe the perfect time for this book to come out and to address an issue that has been one that women have struggled with forever, but as you say many times, was not acceptable to discuss in a public format. I mean, right. We weren't allowed to be publicly angry. We weren't allowed to show that. We weren't allowed to discuss it. And as your mother's plate throwing incident so well shows, we do it in private because we don't want to be labeled. But now, you know, the strength in numbers, we're collectively pissed off and angry. So maybe this is the perfect time for that book.
Well, you know, in times of political tumult, throughout history, and I think Rebecca Traister documents this really well in her book, Good and Mad, in those times, women are given a lot more leeway to be publicly enraged. But then what usually happens is that there's a retrenchment and a reassertion of traditional norms in which women are then again expected to go back into their spaces, their private spaces, their nurturing jobs, and leave the serious business to men. And I think that those days may have passed. I'm not sure yet because we're in the middle of such a deep backlash, but there's definitely a shift of the ground underneath us. And I don't think that a lot of the prominent male pundits perceive it that way. I think they still think there's politics and there's political anger. And oh, by the way, there are those angry women over there on the side.
And eventually they'll shut up and go away.
Right. And so we need to pay attention to them because actually several people are talking about that right now. So let's like tip our hats to that. But then we're going to go back. I mean, Ross Douthat, I think, was the New York Times columnist who wrote an entire op-ed about the post-midterm elections and its anti-white supremacist message and did not mention any women or women voters. I think he, at one point, he did eventually mention one woman, but even in terms of potential candidacy, he listed a bunch of Democratic men with none of the prominent women front runners. And it was really quite staggering to see an article like that, because you can't really talk about white supremacy without talking about male supremacy. Those two things are completely one, right? And yet he just didn't see that it was worth doing.
So I wonder, how do we as women, how do we take this moment and make it last? And how do we use that anger to propel us into some kind of permanent change and not just be dismissed as part of the angry mob that's out there now? Because that's, you know, everybody is pissed off. Everybody is angry about something. So how do we take that and not be dismissed? What are our courses of action?
So I think what we see a lot of mobilization, right? We see a lot of people who have become politically active in ways that they may not have before. Mm-hmm. And that's really important, right? They're hopefully more people are voting, more people are joining grassroots organizations. I mean, women are clearly the bulkhead of the resistance to authoritarian beliefs and tendencies. They make up the vast majority of people writing postcards, making phone calls, reaching out to their representatives. They've had an explosion of representation in terms of people running for office. So I would say that their anger is clearly fueling political activism and change. Right. I think one of the most important things, though, that can happen is that, two things. One is recognition that the work is exhausting and that it's not a sprint but a marathon. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people who are fairly new to this level of intense activism are burning out. and don't really have the habit of the cadence of the work, which requires you to step back and step forward, step back and step forward. And then the second thing is, it's really important not to try and start from scratch and recreate the wheel, because of course there have been so many people doing this work, you know,
right.
Women of color, racial justice activists, people working on immigration, people working on climate change. I mean, there are people and organizations with expertise who simply haven't had support or money or resources. And we need to be able to recognize that this newfound articulation should be used in support of their expertise and experiences and work, not used to start from scratch and say, I have something to say, right? But I think it's clear that the anger is a catalyst for all this activity that we're seeing.
I think what you just said really brought something to mind, and it's something that you talk about in the book, about the difference between the anger of women of color, and maybe difference is not the right word, but the anger of women of color, and
right.
now the anger of the, you know, the liberal white women or the white women who are reacting to what's going on in politics, because we've really never faced it in quite this public way before. And it's, I can imagine there's a level of frustration in some ways with women of color and their anger and say, oh, now you're going to pay attention.
Absolutely.
White women are going to, you know, are making some noise, you know, that's got to be frustrating on some level. And how do we as women come together as a group and support one another and not make it about a racial kind of a thing? Because there is that danger, and we don't want that to be the thing that divides us again.
Right. And I think that those concerns are legitimate, right? I mean, if you think about the Women's March, I think the question of why this, why now? I mean, if you look at women who started the Black Lives Matters movement, for example, or women who have been fighting against the tide of mass incarceration as an anti-democratic facet of our society, they have legitimate cause. Like, why didn't white women show up to support us when our children were being murdered and our communities were being destroyed? And I think that really requires people to listen, you know, mm-hmm. and to be introspective and to say, actually, that's right. Like, what was that? Why didn't I do that? You know, and not to be dismissive of that, or, and this is the other thing, not to feel personally indicted.
Yes, and that's huge. I think that's huge. Because I think that's the thing that ends up separating us. And it's, you know, it's not a matter of you personally are wrong. It's a matter of we felt neglected, understandably so. And I, as a white woman, can look at that and go, yeah, you guys are right. Like,
yeah,
we should have been on the front lines with you the whole time.
Right. And I think the issue is, one helpful way that I think to think about it is not necessarily in racialized terms, but in terms of status, right? Mm-hmm. So men have higher status than women uniformly within communities, right? So black men have higher status than white women. White men have higher status black men have higher, you know, within each demographic group, men consistently have higher status.
Right.
And so understanding what it's like to be dismissed or ignored by a man in your own social group is pretty much the same dynamic as having white women with higher status interacting with women of color with lower status, right? And so I'm constantly saying to men, you know, there is something very important that you can do. It's not that you don't have a role. It's not that you don't benefit from the privileges of male entitlement. You can just listen. Just listen to what we're saying. Don't say anything right now. Process it. Think about it. Consider your own entitlements and privileges, and then ask us what will help. Don't tell us what you think is better for us, because that's just kind of more paternalism and patriarchy. But that same dynamic of status asserts itself in all of these other ways, you know? And so I think it's just probably important to think about what listening means at this particular time, you know, and to step back and think, okay, we do need to trust these black women leaders who've been working for 30 years, 20 years, 10 years, you know, and see why it is that we are unwilling as a society to view them as leaders, right?
Right.
And to support them as leaders.
Yeah. And to maybe hand them the reins at this point.
That's exactly right.
Instead of the white women coming in and saying, well, this is what we should do. This is how we should run this whole thing. And maybe we just need to say, you know, like, you guys take the lead here and we're right behind you.
Right. And I think that we're seeing a lot more of that. And I think we saw that in these midterms, right, where we had the most diverse group of people to enter Congress ever.
It's amazing. Yeah. Finally.
I know. And it's still, you know, we're all very glad, but who are we kidding? We're still roughly at 20%, right?
Right. I mean, it looks like the floodgates were open, right? What was that, Kath?
I just said we still have a long way to go.
We have a long way to go.
Yeah, but what a great message now for our daughters. I mean, you know,
our sons.
Daughters. That you know, I tell my kids all the time, they're growing up in a time where inclusion is huge in our school district, at any rate. And like my kids saw, and this may seem small, but it's kind of big. They watched the women's national soccer team win the World Cup and get all that TV time that had never happened before, right? They're growing up in this time where women are, and the women, a woman candidate for presidency. And they also, that made some really interesting conversations at my kitchen table about how she was being treated versus, you know, her opponent and all the issues that are happening. But what a time that our younger kids are growing up in to see this, and then to see that election that just happened with this, you know, the midterm with all of these women, and the diversity is huge. And then how do we keep going with that? Like I always say, you know, it just because the election ended doesn't mean the conversations have to end. And that tends to be what happens. It's on TV for 5 minutes. You know, it's in Twitter for 5 minutes, and then they're moving on to something else. And maybe, I don't know, maybe my family's a little different that we sit and talk about it a lot. But I'm also in a field where it's dominated by men, like many, in a medical research field. And women are constantly being pushed aside. But interestingly enough, in the rare disease community of patient organizations, women lead that. Moms are driving scientific research that is unbelievable. And then what ends up happening? We turn it over to a lot of men in the venture capital, biotech, all that kind of thing, right? And the moms, because then you're exhausted by the time you get there. And you say, okay, I did all this, you know, pushed it, and then they take over. So that's a step that a lot of women in this field are trying to hang in there and continue with biotechs and all that.
And I think you just described something that's really common for women, right? The more the money gets involved, the more the visibility is prominent, the higher up the ladder you go, the fewer and fewer and fewer women there are.
Yeah.
And that's consistent everywhere. And you know, I kind of laugh that it's not, we don't have a glass ceiling. Like we have a thick wall of sludgy testosterone, right? And it's not like the glass ceiling metaphor is just a dumb one, because
it's prettier than sludgy testosterone, which is accurate.
But we have to, like, you know, it's like you have to navigate in slow motion against this resistant force all the time.
And it is exhausting, don't you think?
And it is exhausting, right?
Yeah.
And also, though, this is an interesting thing that I've really noticed. Like, I've been on the road. I've probably spoken more than 50 times in the last 3 months. And over again, what I've heard is how important, and you and I just had this similar exchange, how important it is for our girls to see these role models. And I just feel very strongly at this point that we need boys to have women role models, even more than girls. Because girls grow up learning to cross-gender empathize. We have to see ourselves in men. We have to see ourselves in male role models. I mean, the minute we look at literature or history or our politics, if we don't cross-gender empathize, we are kind of left bereft of any sense that we have a role, because there's so few women, right? But men and boys never have to do that. And so we need boys to be able to say, my God, I really admire that woman. I want to be like that woman. Yeah. And that is unheard of in our culture.
That statement just shocked me, because I'm thinking, what boy has ever said that?
Yeah, I want to be like that woman. And that is the problem we face, because even if the girls have confidence, even if they know they're smart, even if they're assertive or aggressive or really mad, what they get back from their peers, it's not just what they get from their fathers or their teachers or their coaches. It's from the boys that they live with, their own brothers and their cousins and their classmates, is the mockery or the performance of a kind of toxic masculinity that it's really deeply sexist, right? But we don't call it sexism. We call it teasing or, you know, fratty behavior or, you know, rudeness. We don't even think of bullying as sexism, which is what a lot of it is. Even the homophobic bullying is deeply sexist, right? Because it is the bullying of boys who say they want to be like girls.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think the earliest possible time of intervention, and there is no earliest time, right? Like, you literally have to start in the crib, is to really think through how we teach boys to relate to women as adult women, right? Not as people whose discipline and authority they have to overcome and deny or dominate, but as people to admire.
Yeah, it's like the gender has to go away. I think that's what happens in my house by default, that the gender, because I'm in the leadership role that I'm in, and their father left because of my success and my notoriety and all of that. And the kids then saw, and that's where a lot of my anger, this book was, a lot of the stuff in your book, I went through for 2 years of all this journey. But, you know, they see women here at my house a lot that are in positions of power in terms of their field and making things happen. And I always joke that my family does believe that women run the world. It's a whole different scenario here. And my oldest son will say he wants to be like his mom in a lot of ways. But that's just been their example. And if that could be in more homes, that would be great. And if more boys, could see that. And then I guess we just have to make that available. Your son to some successful woman's work day, you know. It's like a cross thing, not take your child to work day, but take your son to go see a successful woman day kind of thing, you know.
Right. I mean, because honestly what happens is kids are used to seeing women as authorities up until the age of 6 or 7, right? Women are their teachers, they're their mothers, their grandmothers, their aunts. Very often they're doctors even, because pediatricians tend to be doctors. And then they leave that private sphere and they go into the public world, and there is an acute loss of that, right?
And it's an immediate thing. You're right, at a certain age. Boom.
Right, and people wonder, why is it that the age of 5 to 7, that girls start to doubt themselves? And this is not rocket science, right?
Yeah.
It's representation. And so I think that it's really hard to do it as individuals. Even as parents or teachers, it's hard to counterbalance that tidal force of the culture, which is, frankly, like for me personally, that's why I work with so many organizations that are focused on representation in media and technology, so that we can try and change those narratives and make diversity and inclusion priorities, so the representation changes for children, you know?
That brings back that whole concept of what you were talking about with the indictment, being personally indicted. And I think that is a source of conflict with this whole thing, because the whole gender issue, men now are feeling that they're, because of everything that's happened and the Me Too movement and all that, I think men generally are feeling indicted. They're afraid to say anything or afraid to do anything because of whatever. So getting back to your point of people having to listen to one another, we all have to recognize that there should just be, the word respect is so lacking in our culture. It just has to be an across the board respect and recognizing, you know, let's just use the cliche, we all should have the same rights and yada yada, but it has to start at the most basic with that recognition that we all need to respect one another's men, women, and whatever, and go on from there. But it is a long conversation.
Yeah. And honestly, I mean, I put this in the book. If men feel that way, welcome.
How does it feel?
Yeah, right.
you know, I'm yeah, like, yeah. all right, that, so like, what else is new, dude?
Right.
Because if you feel that way, then you know what it's like to feel like most women, right?
Yes.
Every day.
And it has to be part of the conversation and their awareness of that. You're right.
You know, and I have, like, I understand that it doesn't feel good to have to examine your own behavior and your own privileges. And I have so many of them, right? Like, there's so many that I am aware of and I forget about. And, you know, every word I write, I'm thinking, okay, well, what assumptions am I making here that are really not good assumptions, you know? And sometimes I get it wrong. But that's another thing. Like, it's much harder for us as women professionally to make mistakes.
Oh, yeah.
It's much harder for us to say, oh, you know what? I changed my mind. Like, can you imagine saying I changed my mind? I had a woman say that to me once about 3 months ago, and I almost fell off of my chair. I was like, I can do that? Right? Because I have to change my mind so carefully.
Yeah.
You it's know, constantly under inspection.
Constantly. You know, and the idea of changing your mind for a woman is linked to being irrational.
Right.
As opposed to being thoughtful.
Thoughtful. Mm-hmm.
You know?
So I wanted to
hysterical.
Take... yeah, right. Exactly, Kath. You're right.
We're deemed hysterical. Yeah.
Yeah. So I actually wanted to take this to a little bit of a personal level because it just struck me in reading and in talking about the whole thing. When people say, my family, you know, for example, and this mostly happened, thank God they're all out of the house and it's less, there's less, we're less fraught with discussions, but you would say the same thing to them 15 times. And of course, by the 16th, you're yelling. And they're saying, well, what are you yelling about? And I'm saying, if you would have just listened to me the first right. 15 times I said this, I wouldn't be yelling. So on a personal level, that dismissiveness exists, I think, in every woman's family and life because nobody wants to hear you telling them you have to do this, that, or the other thing.
Right.
But then it carries on to the public sphere where we're not being heard. And it's not until we're screaming and ranting and raving in a crowd with pink little hats on our heads that people are finally paying attention.
Right. And what you just described, I think, is really centrally important because, like, I wrote a chapter on denial and another chapter on silencing, which are two different aspects of our experiences, right? Mm-hmm. One is just the flat out, you can't be serious. It can't be that bad. I didn't hear you. Mm-hmm. Fine, you said that. Now can we just keep going like with business as usual? And there are lots of psychological mechanisms for denial, and particularly in defense of masculinity and of male privileges and power. But that's different from the act of silencing, right? Like the social constructs that contribute to women not being able to say what happens to them, not being able to say what the harms are, and then not be taken seriously in either case, whether it's denial or silencing. And I think that has to start at home. I think it has to start, you have to practice at home, you know, you have to practice at the dinner table, in the kitchen, in the car, in the bedroom. Like, those are really hard conversations. And if you don't have a fluency with having them, you can't take that to work or into politics or into other public spaces.
Yeah, I think that all of this has to start at home. And I think we need to recognize how, and I'm not going to say how we contribute to it. I don't mean that, but how the dynamic in our own homes ends up shaping to some degree or another the public discourse and the way we end up then behaving in public. There has to be an accountability of how we are relating to and speaking to our own families and demanding, listen, I'm not just saying this. How many times have women said this? I'm not just saying this to hear myself talk. I'm saying this for a reason.
Yeah.
So
right.
You know, that measure of in your own home, getting people to pay attention to you.
Right. And you know, it was interesting because the situation that women face, most women are in heterosexual relationships, and studies of heterosexual marriages show the degree to which men in those marriages consider their wives' anger to be selfish, right? they don't consider it legitimate. And that's a big problem, right? It's why 70% of divorces are initiated by women. You know, women initiate divorce at twice the rate, more than twice the rate that men do. And that's a meaningful statistic. You can't really have intimacy or an egalitarian relationship where there's a fair distribution of work and time, paid and unpaid, childcare, elder care. You can't have that be egalitarian if one person considers the needs of the other person, which is what anger is about, to be selfish.
Mm, right.
And so the institution of marriage itself reproduces those gender norms and in super unhelpful ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Kath, what are your thoughts? You have two girls. Do you see this whole anger issue being something that you see in them? I mean, they're both, so your one daughter's what, 16 and the other's 11, 10?
She's 10, yeah.
So how does that play out in your house?
It's funny because I was thinking about how back in my house when I was growing up, and, you know, I think it was everything was a secret. You know, on the outside, your family was perfect. On paper, you had everything that you needed. You weren't allowed to take those problems outside in any way.
Right.
So you couldn't do that. With my girls, I want them to be able to not only experience that emotion, but express it.
Right.
And not be judged by it.
Right.
So that's what I'm trying to do, but it took me a while to find my own voice.
That's the first step though, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the simplest thing that I hear is very often a woman actually just being able to say, oh, I am angry. Like, it is that simple. Mm-hmm. Because the words themselves are so hard to say. You don't have practice saying them. You can't connect it to what you're experiencing because it's so transgressive in some communities.
Yeah.
You know, especially, I mean, I grew up Catholic.
Me too. We all did.
We're all in recovery.
We're all recovering Catholics. Yes.
Like, I don't even have to explain that to you, right?
Nope. Yeah.
Like, that is just, and the thing about Catholicism, like, I belong to several secular women's organizations, and with deliberation, right? Because the Catholic Church ritually silences women.
Oh, without a doubt.
It is part of the faith. It is part of every religious service. It means that girls and boys only see men as authoritative speech makers and mediators to divinity. And that's just dumb. Like, there's no other way to put that, right? And so you think to yourself, okay, I know people who are liberal Catholics and who believe in women's equality, but every single week go into a church where that is the lesson their children learn by osmosis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And everyone has to make their own personal decisions, right? Like, it was my personal decision at 13 not to go to church with my parents. And they respected that, right? I would go on high holy holidays. I stopped taking communion. I talked to the priest. I talked to my parents. I was like, this is just unacceptable. Like, what do you mean I need a penis to do this job?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this is what we're talking about.
And they kind of shot themselves in the foot with that one, didn't
they? Well, yeah, didn't they? So, but basically, though, that's the level of conversation that we need to be engaging in, right? Because in fact, you cannot support women's equality and at the same time support an institution that is so profoundly misogynistic.
Yeah, for sure.
And at the same time impose all of these feelings of guilt.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Guilt and danger.
How many men feel that Catholic guilt versus how many women feel that Catholic guilt? I mean,
and this is the other thing, too, about anger that I find interesting. Men associate anger with guilt, women with shame.
Yes.
Now those are really different, right? Like guilt implies that you have some control and that you maybe did something wrong. I feel guilty because I did something wrong. Shame though, is that you are something wrong. There's something about you.
Something wrong with you, right.
There's something wrong with you. And that's a big difference. Like we would have to have a closing of that gap between guilt and shame to have a sense that there is an equality in the distribution of these emotions and their uses.
Yeah. So this is a hugely wide-ranging topic, and we have probably just scratched the surface. But can you give us a couple of little closing thoughts maybe for how we can progress and use this rage as an emotion that will propel us forward? And tell us where we can find you. We want everybody to know where
to find you. So, you know, I'm pretty singularly focused on the long tail of childhood socialization. Mm-hmm. There is what we can do as adult women for ourselves and our own lives. But in fact, I think we have this immense power, which is that within this sex-segregated, labor-distributed world we live in, emotions and childhood nurturing are the realm we've been given to have authority in. And so I think we need to use that power of making other people comfortable. That's the role, right? That's what nurturing is. We're supposed to take care of people and make them comfortable and grow them into ethical, moral human beings. But that quality of making people comfortable, we need to make people comfortable with the discomfort they have with us, right?
Yes, like, I like that a lot.
Yes, yeah, sit with that discomfort and understand that women can say no unapologetically and with authority.
And it's
stop
not
right
a personal,
there.
And it's not a personal affront. It's not a personal attack against the other person.
Right. And we have the ability actually to ungender the emotion and to instead of thinking first gender, we want to grow ladies and gentlemen. That's really corrosive, right? Just grow good people. There's nothing about manners that has to be gendered, right? Nothing. Perfect. Nothing about manners have to be gendered. And a lot of what we're talking about falls into the bucket of the way we think of politeness, right? Girls are supposed to smile more. They're supposed to put others first. They're supposed to use their nice voices. And so the same way that they learn to, I just said this in a speech actually, but the same way that they learn to tame their hair and cross their legs, they are supposed to bite their tongues and eat their words. Yeah. And so we need to stop that. And we have the power to do that. And we have the power to hold our institutions accountable for teaching emotional competence, not gendered politeness. Those are very different things. And so I would say focus on how you interact with children and hold institutions accountable for the same thing. The big bridge is between what we think of as this private realm and the public world that we live in.
Very good. Oh, we lost Mary Fran's sound.
Oh, no. No, there she is.
We can hear. We can't hear you.
Can't hear you, Mary Fran. All right. So where can our listeners find you? Can anybody hear me?
Yes, I can. Yeah, can you hear me? So I am on Twitter at @SCHEMALY, S. Shamali. I'm also have a Facebook page, which is under my name, Soraya Shamali. And I write for lots of different outlets, but I tend to share in those two places mostly. And I'm also with the Women's Media Center. There's an initiative there called the Speech Project that is dedicated to increasing women's civic and political participation. And I'm the director of that organization.
I don't know. Am I back at all?
There you are.
Yes, there you are.
That's another thing I wanted to talk to you about. So we have to do that another time because that was fascinating to me too. So, Soraya, thank you so much for joining us. This has been an enlightening, incredibly informative, wonderful conversation. Thank you to all who are listening to us, and please leave us a review on iTunes. Let us know what you think about Soraya, which I am sure you'll all love her because we do. And we will see you next time on another episode of Four Chicks Chatting.
See ya.
Thank you. Thanks so much
Thank
for having
you so
me.
Much.
Have a good weekend.
You too. Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks for listening to our chicks. Want to learn how to create your own chick chat? Head to our website. chickschatting.com. Be sure to join our chats on that social thing, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.